Hello and welcome to Higginson Strategies Behind the Story podcast. To mark 100 years since women secured the right to stand for election, we're asking, why haven't we reached equality yet? I'm Jess McVeigh, and sitting opposite me is Labour MP and prominent women's rights campaigner in Westminster, Caroline Flint, and former lobby journalist, in fact, The Sun's first female political correspondent and partner at Higginson Strategy, Clodagh Higginson. Welcome to you both. So, to start, there are some that claim because of equal opportunity, we have reached equality. Caroline, you've been MP for over 20 years. You're living in this every day. What would you say to that?
I think equality is something you strive for because I suppose I've always thought that, and even more so having been an MP for just over 20 years, is that you can pass laws with all the best intentions in the world, but actually it's how they are implemented that really counts. So we have had, even before, you know, I came into Parliament in 97, we had equality laws, equal pay laws. But it's clearly the case that when it comes to pay, women are still behind. I think, wasn't it last weekend, that between now and Christmas, women are actually working for nothing. And that reflects the gender pay gap. So it's, I think it's always something that you cannot rest on your laurels by just passing a piece of legislation. It's how it happens in practice. And that's because when it comes to equality, whether it's for women or for other groups in society who maybe don't get their fair opportunities chances in life, is it's the sort of covert discrimination that goes on, the culture of discrimination that isolates individuals and groups of people that we always, you know, need to be aware of. And that's why, you know, sadly today, you know, my daughter does have, she's 30, she has more rights than I have, but I would say for young women like her, there are still issues around, you know, who cares for the children, assumptions made about who's going to care for our, you know, dependent parents and this sort of thing that often put a pressure on women in a way they don't do for men. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, thank you. And Clodagh, as an observer working the lobby for many, many years, did you witness what Caroline just mentioned as this kind of covert culture of discrimination in Parliament?
Well, yes, absolutely. Sadly, initially, I mean, I was very much welcomed by my sort of male counterparts in the parliamentary lobby, which is the body of parliamentary journalists based at Parliament. But I recall sort of in my first Sunday being responsible for the entire political coverage of the newspaper for that the following Monday, a male MP coming into the office to look for one of my male colleagues. And I told this chap that, the male colleague wasn't there. He then sort of turned on his heel and left without sort of acknowledging me. And it turns out that the next day he said to my male colleague that he'd been chatting to his secretary. So, and that was 2007. And I'm sure Caroline, having joined as an MP in 1997, will remember that, you know, the old boys club that it felt very much like was even more pervasive back then, was it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, in 97, I mean, you know, we did have, Labour elected 101 women MPs, and that was, you know, 650 MPs, but still that was a massive change. And of course, that, I mean, just on the practical issues, there was a barber's, and that became a unisex salon. Oh my God, you know, this was like terrible, you know, these awful women taking away the barber's. More, you know, in the lobbies, the I know lobbies where we vote, there was a loo, but it was only the gents. So they had to put in a women's loo because, I mean, I'm not being funny about it, but, you know, Labour had a lot of MPs back then. You know, I think we had 419. And when you're going through a lobby and the crush going through, you can be called short and you need to go to the loo, but you've got to get that, you've got to, you know, before you go and vote. So we had to put that in, you know. And, you know, there were various things, you know, just in terms of just the feel of the place that started being changed. And, of course, this was all seen as terrible and undermining culture and tradition. And, of course, in 97, you know, compared to the hours we do today, we could literally be here all night because it was very much built on the premise that every day Parliament sat at 2:30 based on male lawyers who would work in the courts in the morning, going back hundreds of years, and then have a nice lunch and then do the business in the afternoon. And there certainly was none of, you know, some of the sort of changes very good change we've seen today. But Clodagh, what you said about, you know, how you're identified. I can remember early on with a colleague of mine from Doncaster, Kevin Hughes. We had a joint meeting with the head of the Environment Agency. And anyway, we met them in Central Lobby. We were walking to one of the rooms for our meeting. And he turned to me and said, "How long have you worked for Kevin?" I mean, it was just classic. I have to say, there have been occasions in the office, and I have been known to do this in more recent times, is that when, you know, nobody's here and the phone goes out in the staff office, and I've answered the phone, I have pretended to be my own secretary. I mean, so, you know,
to see what they're saying about you.
Well, you know, just to basically, so I don't necessarily have to pick up the phone and have the conversation, yes, and get caught on the hop sort of thing. So, you know, you can sometimes work it in a really reverse way as well. But I mean, you know, it is the case. I mean, I have heard of stories of colleagues in more recent times, you know, we have certain lifts that are for, you know, members only, and female colleagues being asked, "Sorry, what are you doing in this lift?" And they say, "I'm actually an MP," you know, sort of thing like this. Mm. So it's, I think some of that still goes on. But I mean, I'm also very mindful, and always have been, that we are MPs and we have certain power, you know, in a way that many other women don't have in their own workplaces. And you know, we use our own experience as women, and we should change and modernise the House of Commons. Mm. But, you know, let's be mindful that there are lots of other women in other walks of life who just don't have that power to, you know, stand up for themselves.
Mm. True. And it's, you know, so change is coming and has been coming, but it's still very slow, isn't it? You know, if you look at the percentage, for example, if we look at the parliamentary lobby who cover Parliament, I think it's something like 60 women to 139 men. And then if you're looking at sort of political bylines on the front page, I think 9 out of every 10 are written by male reporters. And I think what that is a sort of, it's a knock-on effect overall in terms of the sort of the feeling of content. Because if you have one third of MPs being female, and if you are, for example, again, going back to that sort of lone reporter working on a Sunday, yeah, and you're trying to, you want to give sort of the best quote to illustrate the news story that you're running, and if it's a case of trying to just find an MP to answer the phone to you sort of late on a Sunday, well, let's be honest, with the best will in the world, you've got a 1 in 3 chance of getting a female. And to be perfectly honest, when you're trying to cover that amount of stories on your own late on a Sunday, you're going to take the first voice that comes along. Mm. So even if you wanted to exercise your own sort of positive discrimination and seek out a female voice, if they're not there, they're not there. So, you know, I think I would certainly like to see more female MPs and more female political editors.
It's very interesting. I mean, obviously, this is 100 years of the first women getting the vote, because we need to remember that it was only some women who got the vote 100 years ago. They had to be over 30. They either had to be a registered property owner or their husband owned a property. And interestingly, at the time those women were given the vote was extended to all men. So all working class men got the vote, but not working class women.
And you had to be of means.
Yeah, you had to be of means. But the story is, the reason why they didn't extend it to all women on the same basis as men, because it was the end of World War One, and obviously a lot of young men had lost their lives. If all women had got the vote, they would have outnumbered the number of male voters.
More female voters.
So clearly, even at that significant point, when women got the vote, some women got the vote for the first time, there was still at play a calculation about, we don't want these women over influencing,
giving with one hand politics. And taking with the other.
So it took another 10 years. 1928 for all women to have the vote on the central main. And here's an interesting little stat for listeners. Since 1918, there have been 4,681 men elected to the UK Parliament. There have only been 489 women ever elected. That's less than 1/10 of the total. So I am number 201. And until 2 years ago, there have been fewer women MPs ever than there were men sitting in the House of Commons at any one time. So it gives you some sort of sense here that, you know, yes, we've made great strides, and certainly since 1945, and of course 1997 was an important time. But actually, you know, you look at those numbers, 4,681 men since 1918, 489 women, it sort of puts it into proportion. Mm.
Is it being now addressed to sort of for young parents? I don't want to say sort of for working mothers, but you know, are there creches here now? Is there childcare available? Because I'm not just talking about it being sort of a females bearing the brunt of childcare, but it's because of the nocturnal atmosphere here and having to sort of be here so late. How's that?
Well, a couple of things have changed, Clodagh. I mean, when I came into Parliament, before I was an MP, I was involved with a national childcare campaign. And one of the first things I did, there's all party parliamentary groups. These are cross groups on particular interest areas. So I thought, well, actually, I wonder if there's an all party childcare group. I found there was an all party caravan group. There was an all party beer group. But there was no all party childcare group. So I set up the first one. And one of the things we did was look into not just facilities, but also what other family-friendly policies there were. And bearing in mind, in 97, this was when we did say, for the National Minimum Wage legislation, we were here all night till 9:30 in the morning. My friend Laura Moffat, who was the MP for Crawley, who had an office next door to me, we had sleeping bags in our office.
That's crazy.
And we would literally camp down in our office in between votes during the night for that sort of thing. Anyway, we did a survey of all staff, and one of the issues was about having a workplace nursery. Anyway, here's another thing that happened. Suddenly there was a media story about how we were going to turn the shooting gallery into the creche. I mean, I wasn't quite sure what a shooting gallery was, you know. And, you know, I thought, well, hey, well, what is this place? I couldn't even in my mind's eye imagine what it looked like. So I went down, and in the bowels of the House of Commons, in this room, which is like, you know, no window, and a sort of barrel type room at the end, obviously where they take their guns and shoot at a target. The idea that we want to take ownership of this and change it into you wouldn't even keep an animal
room
in there,
yes.
You know, let babies, you know, think it's ridiculous. But we, you know, I mean, that was some of the sort of thing about, you know, us sort of seeing and rocking the boat sort of thing. But we did do a survey, and we didn't just do it of MPs, we did it of all staff, because there's, you know, about 10,000 people that work across the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And what we found is that, you know, people wanted a mixture of things. They wanted things like help with childcare support, because if you're a member of staff and you live out, you know, one part of London, you might not want to bring your child into a nursery here, but you might have facilities, childminder back where you live. And we looked at some of those policies about for men and women in terms of being more family friendly. Today, I'm pleased to say, you know, there are things like childcare voucher support with all of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's child tax credits as well, which weren't available then. But there is a nursery here, and it's for MPs and staff. My three children, you know, were all in Doncaster because that's where, you know, they lived and where they went to school, you know. And so for me, that wasn't an issue here. But what was important for me was when we modernised the hours and made them more sensible. Not that I could get home to my family every night, because, I've, you know, for 20 odd years, I've basically come down on a Monday and gone back on a Thursday when Parliament's sitting. But, you know, the massive difference as a working parent between more... It's not never going to be 9 to 5, but stopping as we do now on a Tuesday and Wednesday at 7 and on Thursday at 5 is just such a difference. Mm. I mean, I used to when I first started, we used to finish at 10 o'clock on a Thursday. I used to drive to Doncaster. It would be a sort of 4-hour trip. Mm. And of course, I'd be absolutely shattered and have to face, you know, three children on a Friday morning, as well as all my commitments and all of that. So, you know,
life quality.
There isn't a one size fits all for this, for all MPs, because we all have different types of lives. But I think looking at ways in which actually the hours are more civilised, but also looking at other ways of support. So, you know, this is for, you know, men as well, you know.
Of course.
It has to be, because actually we're only going to have equality when men see responsibilities in these areas and their employers, more importantly, see these responsibilities in these areas, not just a women's issue, but actually a human issue.
Picking up on kind of trade-offs and coming into and women in politics, social media over the last years, we've seen a huge rise in the Me Too movement, which has furthered women's empowerment hugely, but also it's brought kind of a new type of abuse along with it for women online in terms of online abuse. And women in politics are disproportionately targeted, and also the type of abuse that they face is also very different to that of men. Mm-hmm. What's your views on social media and what have your experiences been with it?
I think there is evidence that when it comes to abuse, women MPs, you know, I'm not saying men don't get it, but women get it in buckets loads. And it's of a type that is incredibly insulting, personalised. you know, tearing you apart, really, and violent as well. And that is worrying, because I'm sure for most of it, these are just, you know, sad, angry people.
Yes.
Bullies. And if you saw them, they'd probably back off. Mm. But the problem is, with some terrible things that have happened, the murder of Joe Cox, for example, and other things that have happened to colleagues, you just feel more mindful of all this in a way you shouldn't have to, and that's quite worrying, I think. Well,
Diane Abbott made exactly that point, that and she obviously receives disproportionate amount of abuse, both sexist and racist, unfortunately. But she said that she knows that if people met her in the street, they would not say the sorts of things that they feel quite happy to trot out on Twitter to her. And she said, sort of, you know, going back as long as she's been an MP, you know, people used to have to buy a stamp, put it in an envelope, and, you know, even that process may have slowed it down. Yeah, rather than the knee jerk. So it's obviously got its advantages, Twitter and our social media generally, and its disadvantages for women.
Definitely. Yeah. It's the trolling effect as well. If there's a group of people and they're in this sort of echo chamber.
Pack mentality.
And it's like, you know, suddenly you get caught up in things. I mean, you know, I try to... there's a danger you can get sucked into this and spend your whole time on, you know, Twitter watching what people are saying, things like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think some people are just stupid and crap. And then you have to sort of, in some ways, without spending your whole time on it monitoring, because you'd never get anything else done in your life, be able to sort of say, right, which are the ones that have reached a threshold where that is unacceptable? So I quite recently reported to Twitter about a particular individual who said I should be hung. And did let the sort of security people here know at
that
the House of Commons.
That was quite recently,
wasn't it? Yeah. That was over...
Brexit.
What?
What's that?
anyway. And I mean, you know, and it just like, I just thought, for goodness sake, you know. And I, as I say, I mean, a lot of people I will just sort of, you know, disregard, ignore, whatever. But I just think sometimes there's sort of certain points where you think, no, I'm sorry, you're not going to get away with saying that sort of thing.
How did Twitter react?
So I got, first time I've been through it, I got through a sort of email to say, we've received your complaint. And then they said, yes, this person, individual, has broken, fallen short of our code or whatever. The weird thing about it was, which I didn't quite understand, I then got another email from them, which was, it looked like it was addressed to me, but it must have been to the person saying, you have done this. And so I was a bit confused and said, have you sent it to the wrong email address? Am I now getting the email telling me off for what this other bloke has done or whatever like that? So that was a little bit weird. But I mean, the thing is on these things, I don't know, look, I there's part of me strongly feels that if you set up a social media account, as far as possible, whoever it is, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, they should have some authentication of who you actually are. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that would solve all the problems at all, but I think there's other reasons for that as well. I mean, God's sake, grooming and everything else that goes on and vulnerable, you know, chat rooms and all this sort of thing, which particularly young people can end up in. Mm. I think there has to be something. I don't care if someone wants to call themselves Bluebell or whatever, but as long as whoever is who is organising the platform knows that if they need to, they know who this person is. I think that just seems logical. And right.
And Clodagh, obviously, the media has a huge role and a huge impact on politics and the careers of certain politicians too. In your experience, have you seen a bias against female politicians in media, in journalism, that has had an impact on the equality in Parliament?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that too much attention has been paid to sort of women's appearance, which is just a distraction. For example, there's a lot more commentary on what Theresa May wears, her kitten heels and so on. Mm. I think some research recently found that there were four times more likely to be comments on her kitten heels or her nails than anything that Jeremy Corbyn has ever worn. So I think, you know, while there's a lot of, I don't want to say goodwill, there is support for women across the media to be in positions of power. But I do think we've got a long way to go.
Mm. Mm. I'd agree with that. I mean, I can remember when I was attending Cabinet. So Cabinet's every week on a Tuesday. Must have been over a period, I don't know, 2-3 months or something like this. And then a newspaper ran this story and it had Caroline's catwalk. And basically, they take, because when you go down Downing Street, there's always lots of photographers there from, and usually someone from broadcast there with the camera and all this sort of thing. And obviously over this period of time, and they click, click away and you think, God, it's really embarrassing. And then just literally over the period of time, they just took a selections of photographs. And basically this idea that somehow I was parading down Downing Street and had different outfits. Like, I mean, I don't know.
As you do.
Yeah. Sort of thing. I mean, I honestly, Clodagh, I just wish I'd been that organised to plan these outfits so I could have a little theme going on, a little mood thing going on like this.
But that was coming back in the sort of Blair's Babes era. What did you think of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that, I mean, that was a thing as well, wasn't it? About, you know, you had Cameron's Cuties, Blair's Babes, you know, very clever journalists coming up. There's Sonny's usually very good at those sort of like headline things, I have to say. But I think the thing, why is it talked about? Because it's a talking point. I mean, it still is. I mean, you know, we had, 101 women, Labour women MPs came in. It was a talking point. There's no doubt about that. And because it was unusual, it's interesting for people, I suppose.
Well, just recently, I think on BBC Two, there's a new politics panel show hosted by Jo Coburn, the political journalist, and it was an all-female lineup, and Twitter was alive with commentary.
Oh my God, I saw that.
Sort of likening it to Loose Women. Nothing wrong with Loose Women. They cover a lot of, the ITV show that covers a lot of human interest and other topics. But, you know, you had Amber Rudd there, Laura Koonsberg, Jo Coburn, and that was the best that some on Twitter could come up.
You're kind of touching on it now, but both of you have broken the glass ceiling in politics and political journalism. Both of you are a role model to women and men inside and outside of Westminster. What advice would you give to young women who want to enter politics?
Well, first of all, just to say, you've got to love politics. I think you've got to be interested in it. I mean, I never thought I would be an MP when I was growing up. I'd never met an MP really before, you know, I got involved as a, you know, joined the Labour Party as a teenager. But part of it was that I, actually, funnily enough, I didn't do politics at school. I loved history and I loved literature. And what was really interesting for me was learning about how ordinary people changed events, you know, like the suffrage movement, like, you know, all those movements. I mean, I was very involved in sort of organisational anti-apartheid as a young person. I have to say, you know, when I was like 20, 21, I, you know, you did all the marches and you did all this. I never was sure that actually apartheid would end in South Africa. So in my lifetime, to feel that in my own small way, I played a little part in that, it's been a really wonderful thing to experience. Yeah. And I think that's the thing about, you know, if you just do these things just because you want to become an MP or want to become a minister, because I can tell you what goes up goes down very quickly. And it's pretty, you know, hit and miss on those things. But I think you have to have a passion about these things and know what you're doing and what the reasons are for it.
So, well, in terms of becoming a political journalist, I would say that don't feel like it's a closed shop. I think there was that sort of perception that it was a bit of a boys' club, that it was a closed shop within this sort of small group in Parliament. If you want to do it, just sort of go through the normal sort of way to get into journalism, you know, local paper or get onto a sort of website now, make your opinions be known, and also not to fear politics. Politics is, I think, every human interest story you've ever been interested in. So whether it's somebody's, you know, they're struggling to make ends meet or their ambitions or so they can't get the right healthcare, that is politics. It drills down to people's experiences in their life. And that's, you know, if you want to kind of cover that and see how the people who represent us operate and how that works and get that message out, then you should be interested in political journalism.
Yeah. Final question. What makes you optimistic about the next 100 years?
Things can only get better. That was a great tune back in 1997. Yeah. I think what keeps me going is that, first of all, I think there's a whole generation of young women who can both, I hope, you know, learn from the past, but actually really looking forward as well. And actually, because the job is never over in all of this, there's so much more to be done. And I just think it's, you know, fascinating looking at my daughter and her friends, but also looking at what younger women colleagues are doing here in the House of Commons today. You know, in many ways, finding ways to challenge the way things are done, but also come up with new innovative ideas, using social media in a positive way, I have to say, to harness public support for causes that are worth fighting for. So, I'm in the Labour Party. I'm optimistic all the time.
Well, I think, you know, for the next 100 years, I'd like to see that, you know, true equality to come in, but also a recognition that we are different and that can be a positive thing, that women can bring a completely different perspective. Men can bring another. Sometimes they'll agree, sometimes they'll disagree. But as long as there's continued discourse and equal merit given to both sides, that can only be a positive thing. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you so much. Thanks for listening to the Behind the Story podcast for what I found to be a really inspiring conversation. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you've got any feedback about the show or just want to get in touch, tweet us at HigginsonTweets.